Okay. Welcome. Nice to see you all. So now we can continue on the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, Digha Nikaya 16, which we have been doing for the last quite a while. So we'll see what happens next. I'm very impressed that you got the right paragraph there. That's very, very, very key, very kind of sharp observance there, and getting that right, because we've been doing this for a long time. So I'm just going to very briefly just recap on the previous paragraph and what is happening here. So again, the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, in case you haven't been here or you haven't seen or heard the previous parts of the sutta, is all about the Buddha's last travels before he passes away. And he travels between Rajagaha, starting out there, the capital of the Magadhan Empire, and travels north, crossing the Ganges rivers to Vaisali, where he is now, one of the great cities in India of the day. And then, of course, after that, he continues on north to Kusinara, where he eventually passes away. Kusinara is one of the known as one of the four holy places of Buddhism, precisely because that is where the Buddha passed away. So now he's kind of traveling north, and he has arrived at Vaisali, or not quite at Vaisali yet, at Nadika, very close to Vaisali. And these are some of the events that happened at this place. Just now, Venerable Ananda has just asked the Buddha about all these lay people. All these lay people passed away, and some monks and nuns as well. And he asked the Buddha, what happened to them? Where have they all been reborn? And then this is what the Buddha says to Venerable Ananda. This is a passage, this is paragraph 2.8. And I think I already read this one out last time, but I'll just reread it, because it kind of sets the stage for what comes afterwards. Ananda, it is not remarkable that which has come to be as a man should die, but that you should come to the Tathagata to ask the fate of each of those who have died, that is weariness to him. Therefore, Ananda, I will teach you a way of knowing Dhamma called the mirror of Dhamma, whereby the Aryan disciple, if he so wishes, can discern of himself or herself. I have destroyed hell, the animal realm, the realm of ghosts, all downfall, evil fates and sorry states. I am a streamwinner, incapable of falling into states of woe, certain of attaining Nibbana. Evil fates and sorry states. It's a nice rhyme there. I think he probably was very pleased with that when he wrote that. Sounds kind of nice. Evil and sorry states. But so the point here, first of all, it is not remarkable that which has come to be a man should die. It's a very awkward way of phrasing things. It is not remarkable that a person should die, is really what it says. He has kind of overinterpreted the Pali a little bit. Sometimes you have to be careful how you translate these things. And the Buddha says, as we see in a number of places in the suttas actually, that if you come to me too much with these kind of questions, it is actually troublesome for the Buddha. This is one of those things again that reminds you of the humanity of the Buddha, especially now that he's getting older. He's getting more tired. In another sutta he talks about his body falling apart, his skin being wrinkled, his kind of his not being as translucent as it was before, and all of these kind of things. So you see the Buddha also getting old. But also it reminds you that the Buddha, like anyone who can attain deep meditation, but especially the Buddha, a person like that prefers just to be on their own, be by themselves, sit down in the little cave somewhere, whatever it is, and just attain the jhanas or some other kind of profound state, and just be happy with that, because all of these other things are troublesome in comparison, even for the Buddha, which is kind of important to remember that. I always look at Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Brahm is always very keen on getting back to his cave after the meal, especially. People come and ask him questions, and when he kind of thinks that there are enough questions have been asked, then he kind of looks up at the clock. Yeah. And people said, oh, yeah, I better go now. It's very effective, yeah, but you have to kind of know the right time, not kind of make it be too kind of rude or too kind of, you know, unpleasant for in the situation. And Buddha was a bit like that. There's a sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya where the Buddha, I think this is the Mahasunyata Sutta, the great sutta on emptiness, the 122nd sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya. And the Buddha talks about his own abiding in emptiness. And he says that after he comes out of one of these really profound abidings, then when anyone comes to him, approaches him to talk about or ask questions or whatever, then he talks in such a way as to kind of dismiss them as soon as possible. Yes, because actually you kind of you feel the burden of the external world in comparison to the meditation that you can attain as a Buddha, or especially as a Buddha, of course. And here is a similar kind of thing, you know, okay, you are kind, you help people, but the questions that are kind of unnecessary, you don't want to kind of overdo those things. So then he teaches Ananda this mirror of the Dhamma, the way of knowing the Dhamma is really the discourse of the Dhamma called the mirror of the Dhamma, whereby the Aryan disciple, if they so wish, can discern of themselves. All these realms have been, I think, destroyed, have ended, yeah, have come to an end, I think it's probably a better way of putting it, rather than destroyed, which sounds a bit kind of violent, doesn't it? And all of these negative rebirths have come to an end. And interesting, of these rebirths, it is particularly the rebirth in hell and the animal realm that from a Buddhist view is very problematic. And the reason why it is problematic is because once you get into these realms, especially if you are one of these people who does habitually bad things, it is very hard to get out again afterwards. Once you are stuck there, because you have done lots of bad things, it is very, very difficult to get out of these realms. So this is a part of the problem with these things. The ghost realm is not so bad. The ghost realm is often a realm where you go if you are attached to the things of this world, yeah, and you may go there for a while, you may get reborn again. The ghost realm is also the realm where there is some overlap with the human realm. So if you're reborn as a ghost, it seems like, you know, human beings, your family or whatever, they can actually do things for you to help you out in that realm. They can make some merit on your behalf. And if you are a ghost, you can kind of see your family members doing this, or you get some benefit from that. It's the only realm in which you can get a benefit from your relatives doing something on your behalf. That's in the ghost realm. So the really bad ones is the animal realm and the hell realm. These are the kind of the worst realms from a Buddhist point of view, because once you get stuck there, it takes a long time to get out again, usually. Anyway, I am a streamliner incapable of falling into states of woe, certain of attaining Nibbana. And what is this mirror of the Dhamma by which one can know this? Here, Ananda, the Aryan disciple, is possessed of unwavering confidence in the Buddha. Thus, this blessed one is an arahant, a fully enlightened Buddha, endowed with wisdom and conduct, the welfarer, knower of the world's incomparable trainer of people to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, awakened and blessed. So this is the first factor by which you know that you are a stream enterer, yeah? And once you say that to people, they say, yeah, I'm probably a stream enterer because I have unwavering confidence in the Buddha, yeah? I have such powerful confidence, I must be a stream enterer. Yeah? And this kind of, the problem here is that one has to be very careful with how one interprets these kind of things. It's very easy to overestimate oneself and one's attainment, to think that you are a stream enterer, or think that you are this, or think that you are that, even thinking that you have jhanas. Very easy to overestimate these things. So you have to be very careful with interpreting these particular things. And one of the kind of the crucial things here is this idea of what is here called unwavering confidence. And this word unwavering is really the one that kind of is the critical one here. This word avecha pasada in Pali, avecha means like having realized, having known, having understood, having penetrated, having kind of encompassed. Yeah, so it is the idea here is the idea that you have understood the Dhamma, you have penetrated this by insight. And it is through that insight that you actually have that unwavering confidence, pasada, which is the Pali word for confidence here. And the word pasada in turn, which here is translated as confidence, is very closely related to the word saddha in Pali. Yeah, saddha is often translated as faith, pasada as confidence. Confidence and faith in Pali are very closely related to each other. If you've got one, you have the other. They are basically part and parcel of the same thing. Yeah. What is interesting in the Buddhist teachings, and what makes it so different from most other religions, is the idea that confidence and faith are not opposed to knowledge or understanding. Yeah. Yeah, it's not as if it's not the kind of thing that I have faith because it is irrational, that kind of stuff that you sometimes hear. It's the exact opposite. Confidence and understanding, confidence, faith, and knowledge, they arise together. And when your knowledge is perfect, when you have full insight into the Buddhist teachings, that is also when your faith has been perfected. Yeah, precisely because you know it is kind of your faith has reached its maximum. And that is one reason why the word faith is not perhaps the best translation, because in English, faith almost implies a lack of knowledge. Yeah, it's just faith. It's not really knowledge. But in Buddhism, actually, full knowledge is also full faith. Precisely because you have seen for yourself, your confidence in the teaching is complete. So this is what is meant by this. It is not just a feeling that, yeah, my faith in the Buddha or the Buddhism is so strong. Actually, it is that insight, the knowledge that comes together with the faith, those two together, is what makes it unwavering and unshakable. And that is one of the reasons why if you are a stream entry, you can take one route in the world. Okay, I go this way. The rest of the world may go that way, but I go this way. Yeah, it's like you think about the Buddha. That's what the Buddha did. The Buddha, first of all, he followed the ways of the world. First of all, he lived a home life in luxury and indulged in sensual pleasures. Yeah, that's the worldly way. Then he kind of followed the ascetic path that had been practiced by other people before him. He took teachers and all of this. And then he decided to strike it out on his own. And that is when he achieved awakening. He went the exact opposite to where everyone else went. And that is really one of the hallmarks of being an Aryan, is that your view is opposed to what everyone else does. So if the whole world goes to the left, well, you may go to the right. Yeah, and this is kind of one of the things, that independence that is given by that you have if you are a noble disciple. So this is what it means. So be careful with interpreting these things. It's so easy to misinterpret and overinterpret these suttas. And if you overinterpret yourself, well, this can be very problematic, because you go around thinking that, yeah, I've got it. Yeah, you haven't got it. I've got it. So I'm going to, you know, and that can actually be a blockage on the path. You find that in the Anguttara Nikaya, where the Buddha says one of the things that stop you from reaching awakening is overestimating yourself. So you've got to be careful. It's better to be a little bit on the humble side than to overestimate one's attainments. The Aryan disciple, of course, is the noble disciple. It's precisely those who have understood the Dhamma. So this is what that refers to here. And once you have that confidence, then that insight, you understand what the Buddha is. Before that, you look at the Buddha, you have some idea what the Buddha is, but now you fully understand, because you understand the psychology of the Buddha. You understand what he has seen, what makes him different. Yeah, this is what this is really about. And this is what the Buddha says elsewhere. You know, to see the Buddha means to have insight into his teachings. It doesn't mean to see the physical person. That's irrelevant. What it means is to have insight into the teachings. Then you understand what it means to be a Buddha. That is only then you understand these things. It's kind of funny in the suttas, the Buddha says, you know, there's a story about this monk who is on his deathbed, he's dying, and please ask the Buddha to come and see me. So the Buddha eventually comes and to see him on his sickbed, and then this monk says, oh, I long to see the Buddha. And then the Buddha says, why on earth do you want to see this body for? this is not how you see the Buddha. He doesn't say exactly that. I'm kind of adding a bit of a kind of a there, but he says the way to see the Buddha is to have insight into the teaching, so you understand the psychology of the Buddha, what the Buddha actually is from a psychological inner point of view. That is how you understand the Buddha. Yeah, forget about the body. Yeah? And yet, you know, if you look around the Buddhist world today, people are often so preoccupied with things like relics and this kind of stuff. Relics of the Buddha. Yeah, I got relics of the Buddha. And the Buddha would say, well, why do you want to see those relics for? They're kind of irrelevant. Yeah. I shouldn't kind of overdo this, because sometimes it can be inspiring to have a remnant, what may or may not be a remnant of the Buddha. Who knows whether these things really are remnants of the Buddha. It can be inspiring. It gives you a kind of connection, yeah? But remember, that's not really what it is about. That's only a kind of a reminder, in a sense. So this is it, yeah? So this is what it means to be the Buddha. You are the Arahant, the perfected one. This is how I translate Arahant these days. You're perfected in the sense that you are perfected mentally. All defilements have disappeared. You are worthy. The word Arahant literally means worthy. Fully awakened, the Buddha. Full enlightenment, meaning many things, meaning kind of overcoming the defilements, achieving full insight into the nature of the five khandhas and this kind of stuff. I'm going to go fairly quickly through this, because otherwise we will be here a long time. Endowed with wisdom and conduct, vijja chadana sampanno. And this idea that one of these beautiful things in Buddhism is this idea that wisdom, vijja, and conduct, wisdom and conduct always go together. If you are wise, it shows in your conduct. If you're truly wise, there's no such thing as crazy wisdom in the early Buddhist teachings. Either you're crazy or you're wise. You're not both. This is kind of the what you have in the early Buddhist teachings. And so your conduct matches your wisdom. And this is kind of the point here. Because if you are fully purified inside, if you have no defilements of the mind, well, then there is no impulse to act out negative qualities like greed or anger and these kind of things. You're fully purified. And this is one of those important little things to understand, is that if somebody is truly wise, you can actually tell to some extent. You can watch them, observe them. You can see whether their conduct matches with their wisdom, or match whether the conduct actually is appropriate for a certain degree of wisdom. And if it is, then there is a basis for faith there, or confidence in that person. But if you look at them and you see that they do all kind of strange things, well, then maybe you have to be a bit more careful, because something isn't quite right about this. So this is actually quite an important idea, the idea that there should be wisdom and conduct actually should be congruent. They should match each other. There shouldn't be a discrepancy between the two. They should actually work together. What is this wisdom? What is this vijja that we're talking about here? And this is interesting, because the way the Buddha talks about vijja in the suttas, and vijja is related to the, it comes from a root vid, which is related to the English word wit. Yeah, wit. So it is related to being witty. Yeah, it is actually. I'm not making this up. Witty, but also the idea of like ready wit. Yeah, if you are kind of sharp or you are smart or whatever, ready wit. Same kind of idea. So it's actually related to that. So it has to do with this idea of being intelligent, but here more having insight or understanding is really what it is about in this particular context. And in Buddhism, we talk about the three vijjas. The three vijjas are modeled on the three vijjas in the Brahmanical tradition. And the three vijjas in Buddhism are knowledge of your past lives, knowledge of karma and rebirth, and the last one, the awakening experience itself. That is what it is. That is what it's about. Peter.
Assuming a bhikkhu or bhikkhuni could remember something a lifetime, possibly 2,500 years ago,
yeah.
One would have to come to the conclusion that they are an Arya.
If they can remember a long time ago, they have to be an Arya? No, not necessarily. Quite likely there would be, because that insight, that wisdom of being an Arya certainly helps you in your samadhi practice and all these kind of things. It's not absolutely required. Yeah, quite likely. Mm. So this is what the vidya is about, and this vidya is this, when we talk about understanding and wisdom on the Buddhist path, when we talk about insight, these are the sort of things that we talk about, which is fascinating, because it's often quite different from how people often think about the idea of insight. But insight is precisely understanding your past lives, understanding the laws of karma. Why is that insight? Because you understand the nature of reality. To be able to have true wisdom, it has to be based on the nature of reality. If it is based on delusion, how can you possibly have true wisdom? You have to see things according to reality to be able to judge what is appropriate, what is the appropriate action, where happiness is to be found, where suffering is to be found. So this is why these things are real insights. And I think, I know Ajahn Brahm likes to translate vidya as insight, not vipassana as insight, but vidya as insight. And I think that's very much to the point, because these are the real insights that actually, the most profound ones on the Buddhist path. So that is quite fascinating, what these things actually are. We have the welfare, it says here, sugato. Means something like the one who has arrived at a good destination. Gato, gone. Su is good. So arrived at a good destination. Usually these words refer to rebirth. You are reborn in a good place. Before the Buddha, it means kind of arrived at a good destination in this very life. Knower of the worlds. Loka vidu is the Pali word. Knower of the worlds. What does that mean? It means, does it kind of mean that he's an expert in cosmology? No, not really. Even though Buddhist cosmology is an interesting topic in its own right, but it kind of means that. Yeah, it means that to some extent, because Buddhist study of Buddhist cosmology is also about where you can get reborn, what kind of possible lives there are in the cosmos. So it's sort of about that. So what kind of possibilities are there? Where can you go? And what is the connection between these various lives? What are the laws that govern movement from one life to another one? And all of these things. Is it all about what karma and rebirth is about? But what does it really mean? Why is this important? What is the point of knowing about all these rebirths and all these kind of things? And the point is that, remember, the Buddha here, what he is doing, he is searching for a solution to a problem. That problem is suffering. So when you're searching for the solution to the problem, you have to gather all the information available about that problem and about possible solutions to that problem. And the only way, because he's trying to find that solution, he has to kind of look at the whole, all kind of possible rebirths. Are they happy? Is it something detrimental about them? Is there a problem with these rebirths? What are the positive sides? What are the negative sides of these things? And when you see everything, all possible rebirths, you see whether they last a long time, whether they are eternal or not, whether there is real happiness there or not, whether there is suffering, whether there are problems with them, whether they are perfect. Only then can you make a decision about where to find real happiness and where suffering is to be found. You have to know all the potential sufferings and happiness available for a being, for a human being, or for whoever. And only when you understand everything that is available, you have the whole picture, then you can make a decision where to search for that happiness. And what the Buddha sees, of course, is that all of this is problematic. There's nothing here which doesn't have some kind of, is blotched and problematic in some way. And that's why he has to kind of chuck out the whole caboodle and make a full end of suffering. This is kind of what it is all about. So what knower of the world is really, knower of the world really means a full understanding of happiness and suffering here. And that, of course, is related to rebirth, because it is related to what is possible in this samsaric existence. So that is, I think, the best, but the way of kind of thinking about that. knower of the worlds, incomparable trainer of men to be tamed. And men here, probably better to put beings or humans perhaps, or persons to be tamed, people to be tamed. To be tamed, maybe better to put tameable. I like the word tameable. So he's an incomparable trainer of tameable people. So what that means is that you've got to be tameable. If you're not tameable, you've got a problem. So is everyone here tameable? Anyone who is not tameable? If you're not tameable, maybe, I don't know, not sure what happens then. You're still welcome to be here, but there may not be much point, if you're not tameable, because not sure if there is any. But the point here is, I think, simply that, of course, if you come to a Buddhist center and you're interested in the Buddhist teachings and you meditate on all of these kind of things, by definition, you are tameable because you're already on that path. But it may be people who are, not interested in Buddhism or whatever, people who are, who just born in the wrong place or in the wrong realm or whatever, that is when you're not tameable because you don't even have an interest. You have no inclination towards these teachings. And then, of course, you have a problem. So even the Buddha can only teach those who are ready and who are kind of willing to listen to what he has to say. And you see that in the sutta, sometimes people kind of completely get the wrong end of the stick and they start abusing the Buddha and all kind of things. And then they kind of go down a bypath, as it says in one of the suttas, and they disappear. And you never hear about this person again afterwards. So you have to be tameable to some extent. The Buddha is the incomparable trainer or incomparable leader of these tameable people. Incomparable, anuttara, unsurpassed, quite literally. Purisa dhamma sarati. Sarati is like a charioteer or a leader or a trainer or whatever. And of course, the thing about the Buddha which makes him incomparable, there's two things in particular. One is the fact of his wisdom, having a full understanding of happiness and suffering. And of course, that understanding, why that is so important, is precisely because that is what we all want. We all would like to have the highest happiness. We all would like to have an end of suffering. It is so obvious. And sometimes people kind of think, happiness, kind of that's kind of a low, not such a thing to strive for. But actually it is. If you understand happiness properly, it actually is something very worthwhile striving for. Because what it means is just anything which really is superior in the human world. It means contentment. It means kindness. It means anything which makes you feel better. Avoidance of depression and sadness and all of these kind of things. All of that is part of happiness. Everybody surely wants that. It would be very strange if you didn't want that. These are the kind of things that drives us forward with anything in life, is a search for some kind of preferable state in the future and an avoidance of certain things that are problematic for us. So because the Buddha has a full overview of happiness and suffering, he's got basically the key to what everybody wants in the world. So that is how you become the unsurpassed teacher of human beings. You got that key, you got that kind of the thing which everybody is looking for. And also he's unsurpassed because he comes from a sense of compassion. He knows he has the answer. He himself has finished what he has to do. He doesn't really have any more business in the world. And because he doesn't have any business in the world, there is no vested interest for the Buddha. He's not into teaching so he can become famous. For the Buddha, fame is like, I think he calls it, he uses some kind of word like urine happiness or something like that. So it's kind of low form of happiness. This is the thing. So the happiness of fame, for the Buddha, these things are just problematic. He's not no interest in these things. He does it simply out of compassion. And this is very powerful because the majority of people who are teachers in this world, whether they are Buddhist teacher or teacher of anything for that matter, there's always a vested interest. If you are a teacher at the school, well, at the very least, you want to have a salary. Or other teachers may do so for all kinds of reasons, for fame or for glory or for money or for whatever it is. But for the Buddha, it's like a negative vested interest. He doesn't really want to do it. but he realized that he has something very important to help humanity, and for that reason he still goes out. That makes it very powerful. Yeah, it makes it powerful because it makes you feel that when you read these teachings, actually, the Buddha is doing this purely as a gift. Yeah, there's nothing, there's no kind of, nothing hidden behind the scenes there. There is no, he doesn't do this for any other reason apart from the fact that he wants to help other people. So everything in these teachings are precisely for that reason. And that, to me, makes me look at them more carefully. Yeah, read them kind of more carefully and actually consider, knowing that even if there's something there that I cannot accept straight away, to actually give myself time to kind of absorb it slowly, because I know it is there for my own benefit. There's absolutely no other reason for the Buddha to teach. Kind of opens up the suttas in a very different way. So he is the unsurpassed teacher of humans. And yes.
Ask, I mean, following on from your remark just now, that this last journey is a rush for him to do the last attempt to touch base, right, with everybody that is possible, just to say, to practice and strive on. You know, his time is ending.
It is kind of hard to know exactly at what point that he is aware that this is kind of coming to an end. I don't think he is aware of that from the very beginning. It's only really now, I think it's actually after this, that he kind of says that he gives up the life faculty and he says that I'm going to die in 3 months' time. So it's around this time. At this point, he's probably aware that his time is coming to an end, but probably hasn't actually finalized it completely yet. But obviously, he's getting closer. So I would say yes, that in a sense that he's doing that. So he's giving kind of the final advice and these kind of things, and giving the final advice to kind of allow the Sangha and the Sasana to stay on without his support into the future. Is that what you meant?
Because to my basic understanding, that time of his, that region, that time, is very tumultuous.
Yeah.
I mean, the social, politically, is tumultuous. I mean, war is, is brewing. And there was just a schism that managed to salvage, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, and then he's having intense pain as well. I mean, frequently have to withdraw to the deeper samadhi just to drop that energy. Quite challenging time.
Yes, very challenging time. Yeah, I would agree with you. Yeah. So, but I think that's the thing, I think this is a very important part of it, something you see also later on, as what the Buddha says, that, the real refuge is the Satipatthana practice, when you withdraw into yourself and you just stay with your meditation object. That is the real refuge. And of course, at that point, all the external things are not so important. Okay, there may be war brewing, there may be problems outside, but sometimes the spiritual path is more effective when there's war brewing, because you realize the limits of the world, and you kind of withdraw instead to something else.
I mean, and just that year, his clan was decimated, right?
That's actually not in the suttas. That actually is in the Dhammapada commentary. So whether that happened during the Buddha's life or afterwards is a bit unclear. It may have happened soon afterwards. I'm not sure about that. Yes, John Treasure.
I thought the Buddha knew straight away when he was going to die after Amara come and said to him that you've achieved all that what you've come here for.
Yeah.
And I thought he made a decision then that within 3 months he would pass away.
But that hasn't happened yet. Yeah, it comes later on in the same sutta.
Okay.
Yeah, so this hasn't happened yet, you see.
Right.
So this is, getting things in the right order here.
Why only gods and men? Why not other realms?
Gods and men. Okay. Yeah, no, compare the teachers of gods and humans. Yeah, okay. So I'm just coming to that one now, actually. Yeah. So I haven't really. Yeah. Okay, so why does he only teach gods and humans? What are who would you like him to teach? Like ghosts?
Ghosts?
Yeah, yeah.
Animals would be nice.
If you can understand. Yeah. Yeah.
Some traditions have the idea that the gates of hell are
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I see. Yeah. So why only God? I think the reason for that is that gods and humans are the only ones who can really comprehend, who have the ability to comprehend the Dhamma. You know, especially if you're an animal, you know, a dog, you know, is probably going to have a hard time understanding the Dhamma, I think. Yeah. So maybe if you are a very smart animal, but it would be kind of rare. And I think the hell beings, the same, it's just too much suffering. Yeah. You know, suffering is too intense. You don't really have time to listen to Dhamma. It reminds me of one of those little suttas, I think, is in the Udana, where a shepherd, or is it a cowherd, comes to the Buddha and asks for a teaching because he gets so inspired by the Buddha. He says, well, you haven't eaten for a long time. You know, there's no way you're going to be able to understand the teachings if you're so hungry. Go and eat. Come back afterwards. Comes back afterwards, and he hears the Dhamma and becomes a stream enter as a consequence. So you kind of have to find that middle way. The middle way is what allows Dhamma to be, you know, possible to penetrate the Dhamma. If you haven't got the middle way, you have a problem. So I think that must be the reasons. But even all gods, yeah, there may be some gods who are too kind of far away, too long-lived, too inaccessible, and they won't be able to hear the Dhamma as well. But they may, I think that the idea of being teacher of gods and humans, it is more than just the idea of the fact that the Buddha teaches gods and humans. There's also a bit of propaganda, I think, in this. Or maybe propaganda is the wrong word. There's a bit of saying something about the Buddhist teachings. And the idea, of course, what the Buddha is trying to say here is that, well, there may be some gods out there, and they may look very impressive, they may have a lot of light and be very bright and have all kind of powers and things, but that doesn't make them very wise. Yeah, just because you are special doesn't make you wise. So I think the idea here is that once you have an awakening experience, once you are a Buddha, once you are an arahant or whatever, you are beyond any other beings in samsara, regardless of their things. So he's kind of saying that, you know, to the Brahmanical population at that time, well, you know, you can believe in all these gods if you like, but probably, you know, the truth is, I probably have more wisdom than these gods. Yeah. So, and it doesn't, because being a god doesn't necessarily mean all that much. So I think that is part of it as well. It's kind of subsuming the Brahmanical ideas into the Buddhist ideas. Enlightened, Buddha, yeah, same as before, blessed, Bhagava is the word there, the Bhagava, the blessed, which is a very common word in India. If you are kind of a religious leader, you are often called the Bhagava. Oh, he agrees. Yeah. Okay, good. That's the Bhagava. So that is the Buddha. And actually, it's a very beautiful little passage, this one. I usually like to expand it much more than I have done today, because it's really nice to reflect on some of the qualities of the Buddha. These are very, once you understand these things properly, you start actually to give you a connection to the Buddha in a very different way, which is very useful if you're going to have success in your practice. Anyway, then we have the next one is the unwavering confidence in the Dhamma, or faith in the Dhamma, yeah, which is as follows. Well proclaimed by the Lord is the Dhamma, visible here and now, timeless, inviting inspection, leading onward to be comprehended by the wise, each for themselves. So, well proclaimed, svakato, bhagavata, dhammo. Dhamma is well proclaimed. And the exact idea of well proclaimed here, it can mean a number of things. But it probably means that it is well proclaimed, specifically because it is based on the real insight into reality. And also I think it means that it is well proclaimed because the Buddha takes a lot of time to ensure that the Dhamma is consistent, that it is thought out properly, that it has kind of been put into nice categories. You read the suttas, and what you see is how the Buddha has structured everything so well. You have the Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths. You have the dependent origination, the five aggregates, the five hindrances. Yeah, you have everything, and then put together into things like the gradual training and these kind of things, into long suttas.
So it is structured into blocks, and then those blocks are then analyzed in certain ways. And then all of these blocks are sometimes put together into larger entities. So it has this beautiful structure about it. And this, I think, is part of the idea of the Dhamma being svakato, that it is well, really well considered. It is not random. The Buddha doesn't talk without being very deliberate about the words he uses, the phrases he uses. Everything is deliberate. Everything is meaningful. There are no excessive words, nor are there any words lacking. Yeah? The Buddha says elsewhere, the Dhamma is complete. Yeah, everything you need is here. Which is very interesting. It's a very important statement, in fact, because if everything we need is here, why do we kind of go around reading all this other stuff? And there's a tendency for Buddhists to kind of read everything. Yeah, read here, read there, read all kind of things, and then often ending up becoming very confused about what is the real path and what is not. But this is sufficient. I have always felt myself that when I read other things, especially when I read perhaps contemporary teachers or teachers after the Buddha, whoever it was, none of them can really reach the standard of the Buddha himself. Sometimes they may write very nicely, yeah, very poetically and very beautifully, but that is not what the Dhamma is about, to write in a nice way and a poetic way. The idea of the Dhamma is to convey something very profound with using language in a good way, inspiring, of course, as well, but not in a beautiful way for the sake of beauty or for the sake of entertainment or whatever else. So the Buddha is svakato in this way. And that means that when you read it with care. You read it looking for patterns. You read it looking for meaning in things that may seem very trivial and small. Yeah, things like, okay, five hindrances. You know, the five hindrances, there is a pattern here, yeah, there is a certain sequence in these five hindrances. It's not random. There's a reason why it starts off with sensual desire, ends up with doubt. All of these things are integrated in a very coherent and good fashion. Five khandhas, the same thing. It's not a kind of just five kind of aspects of human beings kind of whacked together. Okay, five khandhas, this is who you are. Yeah, it is systematic. It is thought out in a very systematic and useful fashion. Eightfold path, very much the same thing. It is a gradual thing, a causal sequence of one factor leading on to the next one. So this is this reminds you, when you read these teachings, it's very different from reading most ordinary books or most ordinary teachers, because nobody really has that kind of systematic approach to the Dhamma apart from the Buddha himself. I have never anywhere else read this kind of systematic approach. With some exception, there is if you read things like the Visuddhimagga, it is a little bit systematic, but nowhere near, again, as systematic as the suttas, I would say. There's much more, too much information in there to be systematic in quite the same way. So this is well proclaimed, visible here and now. Yeah. And timeless. Timeless actually is the same thing as visible here and now. These words are synonyms. Timeless means that you don't have to wait to see the Dhamma. It is akalika, nothing to do with time. So it's visible here and now. What does that mean? And it means that you can, of course, it means that you can attain the Dhamma in this life. That is one of the things that it means. It means that you don't have to wait till after death to know the truth of these things. But that is only one aspect of this. Another aspect is that you can know that the Dhamma works right here and right now. If at this moment, right now, you apply your mind in the right way, yeah? If you think in the right way, if you think a thought of kindness, if you overcome a defilement in the mind right now, you will feel the result in this very moment. Yeah. So if you, for example, you have a negative thought about someone. Yeah. Hope it's not me, but anyway. If you have a negative thought about someone, yeah, you think, oh, wow, this person. And then suddenly you think, wait a minute, why am I thinking like this? This is silly. And then you turn your mind around, and instead of thinking that silly thought, you think about something else which is beautiful. You remember the good qualities in that person. And the moment you do that, bang, it just shifts completely, and you feel a sense of joy, perhaps, instead. And that is the power of seeing the Dhamma here and now. Akalika, sanditika. It's an immediate effect on you if you do it in the right way. So notice that. Sometimes you're able to swap your mind over and you can see, feel the effect bang, so quickly, so fast. Sanditika Dhamma. Or just being aware of defilements is already a sanditika in some extent. Being aware, oops, I'm getting upset about something. So you stop yourself in your tracks. Inviting inspection. This is ehi pasiko, sometimes translated as very verifiable. You can be verified, yeah? Ehi, come, pasika, passa, see, come and see. So very similar to visible here and now and timeless. Leading onwards, upanayika. This means that the path is always moving, you're moving forward on the path, yeah? Gradually. Yeah? And the meaning of that is that you feel the results of the path. Day after day, week after week, month after month, you feel the results. And if you don't see the results in yourself, then it means that you're probably not quite on that path. You're supposed to see changes in yourself. You're supposed to see that gradually your defilements are going down, your good qualities are going up. Yeah, you're supposed to see that. And if you don't see that, you have to ask yourself why. Because then it's not upanayika, it's not leading onwards, it's not going to the right goal. And if it keeps on being upanayika, if it keeps on leading in the right direction, one day you will get there. Yeah, you have no choice. If it is heading in the right way, one day you will actually reach the destination. So that's all you have to do. Am I improving in the good qualities? Am I declining in the bad ones? Yes. Don't look from yesterday till today. That's too short. Look like a few months down the track. Yeah, 6 months. Okay, what was I like 6 months ago? What was I like 10 years ago? What am I like now? And you can see this movement, something happening. That is what it really should be. And if it does, then things are going in the right way. To be comprehended by the wise, each for themselves. So you have to be wise. Yeah. So that can be problematic, yeah, if you have to be wise, because we may not be so wise, but the thing is that wisdom can be developed. Wisdom is not a given on the path. So wisdom itself is something you develop as you move along. So as you develop wisdom, your ability to practice the path also increases as a consequence. So this is the Dhamma, and again, not going into too much details, because it's very beautiful and very nice way of thinking about the Dhamma, but I think for now that probably is sufficient. But then you have the unwavering confidence in the Sangha, and this is what this Sangha is. It is well-directed, is the Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples, of upright conduct on the right path, on the perfect path. That is to say, the four pairs of persons, the eight kinds of humans. So let me just stop there first of all. Actually, let me read the whole thing. The Sangha of the Lord disciples is worthy of offerings, worthy of hospitality, worthy of gifts, worthy of veneration, an unsurpassed field of merit in the world. So this is the standard expression of the Sangha that you find in the suttas. Well-directed, supatipanno, literally means practicing well. That's really what it means. Why are they practicing well? Well, they are practicing well because these are the Aryans. They know the path. Once you know the path, you cannot help yourself. You have to practice well. Whether you want to or not, you have to practice well. Yeah, so that's a pretty good deal. So even if you don't want to, you still practice well. So you are well-practiced. You have upright conduct. This is Ujju Patipanno, upright practice, if you like. What does upright practice mean, Ujju? And what it means is two things, usually, the way that the word Ujju is used in the suttas. The primary thing is that it is used for straight view. Yeah, it's a bit like right view on the Noble Eightfold Path. Straight view, Ujju Kaditti. You see things in the right way. And because you have a straight view, you know what you have to do. Part of the insight of the stream mentor, of the four of the Buddha's noble disciples is the insight into the actual path itself. Yes, you have insight into suffering, you have insight into the cause of suffering, the craving, the tanha, you understand the ending of suffering, ending when tanha comes to an end, craving comes to an end, but you also see the path that actually leads there. It's interesting, isn't it? How can you have insight into a path? It's kind of fascinating. How is that possible to have insight into a path? Surely a path, what does it mean to have insight into the path? And what it means, I think, is that to be able to have insight into anything, you have to have clarity of mind. Yeah. So if you're going to have the highest insight into reality, you need absolute clarity of mind, no defilements, nothing that blocks you, powerful faculties, maximum samadhi, maximum joy, maximum mindfulness. These are the things that are required. And you have seen that because you have seen, you know where your own insight comes from. It has come precisely from that kind of mind state. So you know that what you have to develop is that clarity of mind. Yeah, and that clarity of mind comes from eliminating the defilements. And this is what the whole Noble Eightfold Path is about. It's about purifying yourself. It is the original path of purification. The original Visuddhimagga is the Noble Eightfold Path. The whole path is precisely about that. Yeah, you have the virtues, you have the right effort, which is very much about sense restraint, yeah, sati sampajanya. You have the mindfulness part, satipatthana part, which is about abandoning the last defilements, and then the attainment of the jhanas. Everything is about the purity of the mind. Everything is about setting the mind, getting the mind ready for real insight. That is the kind of understanding you have. Only that very pure mind is capable of profound insight into reality. So this is what you have seen. You have seen it through your own practice. You understand what you have to do as a consequence of that. So this is the upright conduct or the upright practice, Ujju Patipanna, that you do. You have, because you have the right view, Ujju. The other aspect of Ujju, of straight, is your virtue. Your virtue is straight. In the suttas, they talk about the crooked person. The crooked person is the one that whose virtue is not straight. But if you are astray, it means that you are virtuous. Even mental virtue is to a large extent sorted out by this point. So that is why you are on that straight path. You're practicing the straight path, really, upright path. The right path he has next, the right path is the Nyaya Patipanno. If you remember your little chanting of the triple gem, Nyaya Patipanno. Nyaya in the sutta usually refers to dependent origination. So, or dependent cessation in this particular case. So the Nyaya is how things cease as a consequence of your insight. So if you remember dependent origination, it starts off with avidya paccaya sankhara. Delusion is the cause for volitional or willed activities. All activities we do come from a delusion or illusion or ignorance, whatever you want to call it. Yeah, and of course, once you are a stream enter, which is what we are talking about here, the Noble Sangha, once you are that, you have already eliminated a lot of that delusion at the beginning because you have right view. Huh? Yeah, so because you have that right view at the beginning, because avidya is the cause for sankharas, the sankharas, the activities that you do, how you live your life, your will, your volition is already affected by that insight. And then that will, we have sankhara paccaya vijnana, the activities are the cause for consciousness, yeah, for the state of mind that you have. And then going all the way up to dukkha. Dukkha is the 12th link of dependent origination. So for each link, there is an effect by the fact that avidya has been eliminated to some extent. That has an effect all the way through the 12 links of dependent origination. And this is one of the reasons why once you become a stream enter, the dukkha at the other end is affected. You can no longer be reborn in certain locations, in certain realms, because you have eliminated some of the avidya at the beginning. The direct correlation between the two. So you are now practicing this path of cessation. Yeah, the opposite of avidya paccaya sankhara is the cessation sequence, that when you have the nirodha of avidya, then you have sankhara nirodha. Yeah? Avijja Nirodha Sankhara Nirodha. From the cessation of avijja comes the cessation of sankharas, all the way up. And once you become a stream mentor, you're on that cessation path. The avijja has started to cease. Yeah, and it ceases more and more and more until eventually the whole thing just collapses. You're practicing dependent cessation. Yeah, this is what you're doing here. It's kind of nice, isn't it? The dependent cessation. Or it is being practiced on you. I'm not sure which way is the right way to look at it. It's happening anyway. This is the Nyaya Patipanno. The last one is Samichi Patipanno. Samichi just means proper or appropriate. Yeah, many of these things are just kind of synonyms in a way. It is appropriate because you know what you're doing, because it is leading to the right goal. It is leading to the end of suffering. It is appropriate for that. So synonyms, different angles of which to look at the same thing here. So this is the Sangha. And what is the Sangha? It is the four pairs of persons, the eight kinds of humans. This sounds a bit like Abhidhamma, four pairs, eight kinds of humans. So these are the Aryans, and this is just a particular way of classifying the Aryans, the noble ones, in the Buddhist teachings. The four pairs are the stream mentor, yeah? There's two types of stream mentors, two types of once returners, two types of non-returners, two types of perfected ones, arahants. So there's eight pairs, and then each pair is two, so that makes it eight persons. These are the eight noble ones. Why does the Buddha divide up the noble ones in this way? What is the point? There's a nice little sutta maybe the Samyutta Nikaya somewhere. And there's a discussion between the Buddha and Venerable Sariputta. Venerable Sariputta being the right-hand man of the Buddha, the one highest in wisdom after the Buddha. And this is the place where the Buddha for the first time lays down this kind of idea of the many different types of noble beings. And he talks about the stream mentor and all of these beings for the first time. And then at the end of the discourse, the Buddha says that, well, the reason why I didn't talk about this before was out of fear that people might become heedless and lazy. Yeah. And because the idea, of course, if you are a stream mentor and you are bound for awakening, enlightenment, if you're a stream mentor, but maybe I can just chill. Yeah. Okay, I'm a stream mentor now. Okay. I don't really have to do anything more because I've become enlightened anyway. Now I kind of just, I'm going to relax. Yeah. Take it easy from now on. But the Buddha doesn't really want that to happen. Why not? And one of the reasons is because someone who is even more developed on the Buddhist path is even more inspiring. If you see a stream mentor, you may think, yeah, they're pretty good, pretty cool, you know, I like this person. Cool, I'm saying that deliberately, because in the suttas you have the idea of siddhi bhuto, become cool, yeah? It's one of the descriptions of the arahant, they have become cool. Kind of nice, isn't it? The arahant has become cool. So stream mentor, also a little bit cool, yeah? So you are on the way to coolness. So you look at them and think, yeah, they're pretty cool, emotionally very even. But of course, the more cool you are, the more emotionally even you are, the less defilements there are in you, and all of these things, the more inspiring you're going to be. Yeah, if you see someone who is radically different from anyone else you met in your entire life, because they have so many good qualities, you think, wow, look at this person. This is just outlandish. How can such people exist? And when you see that, and you know that you too would like some of those qualities, you feel so inspired by that. You feel, wow, I'd like to go there. And this is kind of the idea of arahants, or even perhaps non-returners. When you meet people like that, with exceptional qualities, it draws you towards the Dhamma. It gives you faith and confidence that something else is possible in this world. And that's why the Buddha doesn't want us to stop if we are stream enterers. Yeah. So he wants us to go all the way to arahantship. This is one of the reasons, I think, why the Buddha didn't talk about this originally, and only later on did he actually talk about these things. Another reason, I think, is that sometimes people overestimate themselves. Yeah, they think, yeah, now I'm a stream mentor, I can relax. But you're not a stream mentor. Yeah, what if you're not? What if you got it wrong? And the point is that knowing that whether you are a stream mentor, actually it is not as obvious as knowing if you are an arahant. Even arahat is pretty obvious because you have no anger, no sensual desire whatsoever. Yeah, you never even get slightly irritated. You just look up on everything with kind of equanimity. Yeah, you know that there's no more rebirth. Yeah, you know literally, directly, that there is no more rebirth for you in the future. Yeah? So these are the things that have to be satisfied for you to be an arahant. It's much more difficult to get that wrong than to get wrong the idea that you are a stream enter. Okay, stream enter means that you understand non-self. You think, yeah, I understand non-self, yeah. Maybe I'm a stream enter, I wonder. Well, if you wonder about it, you're not a stream enter. Yeah, this is kind of one of the basic truths. If you have any doubts, you're not a stream enter. Yeah. So that is, I think, the reasons why the Buddha is very careful with these things, and he doesn't say it without reason. So why does he say it at all? And I must admit, I'm not entirely sure what the answer to that question is, but I think probably because, just to point out that there are people in the world who actually have insight, and just because they aren't perfect doesn't mean that they haven't got a lot of insight on the Buddhist path. They may still be really worthwhile listening to, yeah? And you should be careful how you kind of treat people, even if they have got a little bit of defilements, doesn't mean that you can treat them, you know, badly or as inferior or anything like that because of that reason. So I guess the Buddha just wants to be realistic about this, realistic about what is there and how the world areas, how they, what the kind of whole scheme of things, if you like. Yeah. So these are the four pairs and the eight kinds of individuals. So, yes?
Humans here not a good translation? It seems to be rather reducing it from gods to humans.
And yeah. Humans. Mm. Okay, let's see what the Pali says. This is why I brought the Pali along here. So we can see exactly what it says. It says, Chattari Purisa Yugani. Purisa means men, actually. Yeah, Purisa Pugala. So that's even more limited here. So, but usually Purisa can also have the sense of human beings. I guess the point really is probably that the Buddha is focusing on the human realm, because everything else is probably a bit, at least for those who are listening, is not so important probably here. Yeah. But you're quite right, though. Of course, you can have areas in the Devaloka as well. So that is an important point. Yeah. Okay, so these disciples of the Lord, they are worthy of offerings, worthy of hospitality, worthy of gifts, worthy of veneration. Why are they worthy of these things? And the answer is, of course, is that anyone who is an Aryan, they have the supreme gift to give to anyone else. They have the gift of happiness. They have a gift of peace, the gift of contentment. They have the gift to give understanding things according to reality. They can give you that thing which each one of us really yearns for inside the most. Yeah, and if someone has the highest gift to you, then of course that makes them worthy of a gift in return. It's like all teachers. Teachers are people that we often think of as gift-worthy, yeah? We may do something kind for a teacher, yeah? But most teachers, they can teach us a few things about, okay, learn how to write English properly, learn how a little bit, learn your multiplication table, that kind of stuff, yeah? Or it can be your parents. Of course, parents are also considered teachers in Buddhism. Some of the most important teachers are parents, according to the Buddhist teachings, because they teach us so much. But the teachers who can teach us the most, yeah, these are the Aryans, the noble ones. They are the ones who can teach us really the, you know, the absolutely the most important things in life, things that give us true happiness. And that's why they are considered worthy of all these kind of things. And they are the unsurpassed field of merit for the world. When you give a gift to the Sangha, and especially to people who are noble ones, then precisely because of their qualities, karmic consequences of that giving can often be very powerful. Yeah, if you feel inspired to give to somebody who has very noble qualities, and you give to them something that they need or whatever, and see what happens in your mind. And if you do it in the right way, it can give rise to a tremendous sense of joy and uplift. You know that this is something very positive and good, yeah? And this is the idea of kamma. You can actually feel it straight away, that something is happening there. Yeah? You go to meet somebody who is very exceptional, with really remarkable qualities, and then you feel that what you're doing towards them, that interaction is very powerful, that generosity and kindness. So that is the Sangha, the unsurpassed field of merit for the world. Who are these Sanghas? Who are these Aryans? How do you know whether someone is an Aryan? And this is kind of one of those things. You want to make lots of merit. Yes, you want to give to the Aryans. You don't want to give to the non-Aryans. So I'm going to give to Ajahn Brahm. I want to give this to you. None of the other monks can have this. Only you. This is for you. Is that the right way of giving? Well, according to this, it sounds like it might be the right way. But no, it is not the right way of giving. The idea, rather, from the suttas, if you want to give, you should give instead of giving to individuals. It's much better to give to groups. Yeah. So you give to the Sangha as a whole. And the Sangha is also the place where you can most likely to find these noble beings, these Aryans. That is where they're likely to be. So by giving to the Sangha as a whole kind of spectrum, everything, you include all the Aryans within that Sangha. Yeah, so that is how that kind of becomes the greatest field of merit, because you include everyone. So you don't really have to think so much about who is an Aryan and who is not. You don't have to kind of evaluate that, because in the end, it is almost impossible to know. You can try, okay, some people you can be pretty sure are not, other people maybe they are, yeah? Okay, Ajahn Brahm, yeah, okay, Ajahn Brahm, I place a bet on him, yeah? But, you know, it's so hard to know. It is better to kind of broaden out your perspective and give to something much larger instead. Give to all of Buddhism. Give to the whole Sangha. Give to this vast thing that we are doing. And then you have a part in all the goodness that comes from what the Buddhist teaching actually does for people around the world. You have a part in all of that. Because you're supporting all of that. And that then becomes much more powerful for that reason. Okay, so unsurpassed field of the merit for the world, so that is the Sangha. Now we can have a look at the last factor. One is possessed by the morality dear to the noble ones, which is unbroken, without defect, unspotted, without inconsistency, liberating, uncorrupted, and conducive to stillness. So you have the morality dear to the noble ones, and this actually is not a very good translation, to be honest with you. There's a lot of defects in the translation. The morality may be without defect, but the translation is with defect. So this is the problem here. So, but the beginning here is okay. It is unbroken. Yeah, it is a consistent morality that you practice all the time. It is there both for body, speech, and mind, consistently, without defect. It is complete. Yeah, it is not partially spotted or blotted or whatever it is here, unspotted. It is a kind of a complete morality. You never really act out of defilements anymore. So this is the first aspect of this, that you kind of live really well once you become an Aryan. You don't really make any mistakes in morality anymore. Without inconsistency is completely wrong. It actually means the morality that is praised by the noble ones, by those with wisdom. That is actually the correct translation. So that is really got that completely wrong there. Liberating, it is a morality that frees you. When you live a moral life, you feel a sense of freedom inside. You don't feel bound by remorse or sadness over your actions or anything like that. You are liberated from all those negative mental states that come from not living well. Also, it is liberating in the sense that it leads to liberation also. Uncorrupted. Again, not a good translation. The Pali means not grasped, ungrasped. So it means that these this
morality, you don't actually have to hold on to it. And why is it that you don't have to hold on to it? The reason is because it becomes a part of you. Huh? Yeah, when you become a stream mentor, because you have understood the path, because you know what you have to do, it is part of who you are. You have become a good person. It is ingrained in you. You cannot avoid being a good person anymore. Huh? It is part of. So that's why you don't have to grasp these things. For the rest of us, we do have to grasp on to these things a little bit. If you don't grasp on to the five precepts a little bit, if as a monk you don't grasp on to your precepts as a monk a little bit, you don't keep them because they need a little bit of holding on. It's not natural for us yet. If you let go completely, you just fall into all the bad ways of that you had previously until you become a stream enter. And this is an important point. I think one of the problems with this kind of passage is that people often misunderstand the message here. People sometimes think that ungrasped here is actually a advice to how we should act. Yeah, the stream mentor doesn't grasp, so we should also try not to grasp onto our morality. Yeah, but that is not the point. This is not a advice on how to act or how to live. This is just a message on what it is like to be a stream entry. If you are a stream entry, you don't grasp. This is how you know that you are a stream entry. It is not an advice on how to practice. Yeah, this is a very important distinction. So it is perfectly okay to grasp onto these things to some extent before you are a stream enter. In fact, if you don't, you're not going to be able to keep these things. This is very important. Sometimes you hear people say, oh, yeah, don't grasp too much onto the virtues and these things, and if you break them, it doesn't matter so much. You know, it's only when you become a stream enter that these things are important and that kind of stuff. And to me, that is really misunderstanding the Buddha's teachings in a very radical and important way. You really got it completely wrong if you think that. That is, in so many places in the suttas does the Buddha talk about the five precepts, the importance of keeping the five precepts. And if you, as a foundation for not having any fear about the future and these kind of things, these things are fundamental for the Buddhist practice. Whenever you see the Noble Eightfold Path, the gradual training, all of these frameworks for how to practice, it is always founded on one thing, always founded on sila. And that sila comes back to the five precepts or more. Five precepts is actually the absolute minimum. Ideally, we should go well beyond that by purifying the mind and all these other kind of things as well. So it's so important to get these things right. Get it wrong. Misunderstand what this is about, and you're going to hinder your progress on the path dramatically as a consequence.
Does ungrasp have the sense of not grasping it with self? Taking it as me or myself, like a Sotapanna has seen through the view of self? You've got that aspect or that quality?
I think all grasping has to do with self to some extent. They all come from self in a certain way. Yeah. So, good. Conducive to stillness is the last one. And this is one of those themes that you see in the suttas again and again and again. This idea of the connection between virtue on the one hand and stillness on the other hand. Such an incredibly important connection. And what it means, of course, is that the more you purify the virtue, the more effort you put into having a pure mind, avoiding the defilements of the mind, and the more you purify all of that, the more powerful your stillness is going to be. This is really where so much of the practice is. How can I purify myself more? How can I be more kind? How can I have less of these defilements? Not just the lack of defilements, but also increase in the good quality. How can I have more compassion and understanding for people around me? How can I have more metta in the world? How can I have a better heart? How can I move in the right direction? This is so much of this practice. The more profoundly, the more fully that is established inside of you, the more you will have the ability to just be mindful, watch the breath, achieve the samadhi, and all of these kind of things. So this is kind of the thing that you need to be reminded of again and again and again. Moment to moment, day to day, week in, week out, year in, year out. You always remind yourself, now, in this moment, what can I do better? Where
How can I act right in this at this very time right now? And if you make every moment important in that way, always asking yourself, what is the right thing to do now in terms of sila, in terms of appropriate conduct? If every moment is like that, boy, you're going to make progress on the path, because this is really where it is at. So that ability to persevere and commit to moment sila, moment to moment, right action, right activity, right thinking, right speech, all of these things. That is the thing that lifts this whole thing forward, pushes it forward, and allows you to then sit down and become peaceful in your meditation later on. So that is the sila part. These are the four aspects of stream entry here. This is what the stream entry is like. That is how you know whether you are a stream enter or not.
Going back to the eight kinds of noble beings, I've heard it say that for the Sotapanna, the stream enter, that the two types of other stream enters are those who are on the path of faith and wisdom towards that. Is that where you come to?
They are called Saddhanusari and Dhammanusari in Pali. And these are the people, they're not actually stream enterers yet, they're on the path to stream entry. But the idea is that there comes a certain point when you make a certain breakthrough, and from that point onwards you are guaranteed to become a stream winner within the same life. At the latest when you die, you become a stream winner. So you have some kind of profound insight into the nature of reality, and that will then mature or give the fruition into real stream entry before you pass away. So it's a bit unclear exactly how that happens, though. Okay, so then the Buddha says, this Ananda is the mirror of the Dhamma, whereby the noble disciple, if they so wish, can discern of themselves, I have ended hell, ended animal rebirth, ended the realm of ghosts, all downfalls and bad destinations. I am a stream winner, incapable of falling into a state of woe, certain of attaining Nibbana. Certain of attaining Nibbana. That's good. Sounds good, doesn't it? Or it depends on your relationship with Nibbana. What is your relationship with Nibbana? It's kind of it's this word which is so interesting. It is so kind of laden with meaning. The idea of Nibbana, basically the meaning is like extinguishment. That's the basic meaning of it. And of course, some people, they think extinguishment, I'm not sure if I really want to go to extinguishment. It sounds a bit scary. But of course, the point is that what is extinguished is suffering. That is what is extinguished. And once you understand that, well, actually, this sounds like a pretty good deal after all. But this word Nibbana is kind of tinged with a little bit of, you're not sure about that. But what you are sure about, and this is what really matters, and this is what is interesting, just a way of thinking about Nibbana, which makes it very attractive, is to remember, when you sit down, when you do a little bit of meditation practice, you feel a little bit more peaceful, you have Nibbana'd a little bit. So how does a little bit of Nibbana feel? It feels good. You feel a bit more peaceful. You have a bit more mindfulness. There are a little bit less defilements. There is less suffering. There's less thinking going on. There's less of yourself there. And it feels so nice. And that is how you see that non-self and all of these kind of scary things on the Buddhist path that can actually seem really scary. Actually, they are very positive. Once you feel them for what they are, you understand how powerful and beautiful they are. So be careful with words, because words can sometimes look scary. Go instead to what these things feel like in real life, and then you understand that these things are incredibly positive things. If a little bit of Nibbana is so good, imagine complete Nibbana. It's much, much, much better again. And this is how you kind of get into these ideas. Let me please continue for a few more minutes, and then we come to a kind of natural point to pause. Then the Lord, staying at Nadika in the brick house, gave many discourses to the monks. Comprehensive is completely wrong, but anyway, did give many discourses to the monks. This is morality. This is stillness. This is wisdom. Stillness, when imbued with morality, brings great fruit and profit. Wisdom, when imbued with stillness, brings great fruit and profit. The mind imbued with wisdom becomes completely free from the corruptions, that is, from the corruption of sensuality, the corruption of desire for existence, and the corruption of delusion, the false views, you can take that out, and the corruption of delusion or ignorance, avidya, which is the last one there. And this little paragraph that I've just read out is one of the refrains that you see again and again in the suttas. Whenever the Buddha stops somewhere on his last trip, going from Rajagaha to Kushinara, whenever he stops somewhere, every village, all the people that he talks to, he always gives this particular teaching. Yeah, and because he gives these teachings all the time, you know, this is the essence of the Dhamma. This is really what it's all about. If you can do this, you are on the right track. This is the Noble Eightfold Path. This is the gradual training. This is the 37 aids to awakening, all packed together in a very brief and beautiful teaching. So remember that, yeah? Stillness, samadhi, when imbued with sila, with our good habits, with the right conduct, all these kind of things, that is of great fruit and great benefit. Only when the stillness is imbued with the sila. The sila is so important, absolutely essential for the Buddhist path. Then, I just like to make this point every time I get to it. I've come to it already 5 or 6 times. Maybe some of you are fed up of hearing this. I enjoy it every time. Maybe I'm not sure why I do that. That's just the way I am, I suppose. And then the wisdom imbued with the stillness. Yeah, wisdom imbued with samadhi. Samadhi is a requirement for wisdom. Only when that wisdom is imbued with samadhi is it of great fruit and great benefit. So, tells you everything that you have to do. Practice sila so well, so thoroughly, so moment to moment, so all the time, until your meditation goes really well. Then, when the meditation reaches the level of samadhi, that is when you are ready for the true wisdom that makes an end of all the defilements of the mind, all these things that I hear called the corruptions, yeah? The things that defile the mind and makes the mind problematic, the asavas, the root defilements that tie us to samsara, tie us to eternal rebirth and suffering going on in the future, sometimes potentially forever, unless you actually make a stop, make an end of these things. So that is what that simple little teaching, beautiful little teaching tells you. It kind of gives a summary of almost the 4 Nikayas in about 2 lines, which is very, very useful. And when the Lord had stayed at Nadika as long as he wished, he went with a large company of monks to Vesali. Okay, to Vesali. where he stayed at Ambapali's grove. And that is a good place to stop, because now we're kind of getting onto a different thing. But just to give you a little preview of what is happening next, just to give you the taste so that you want to come back next time. And this is Ambapali. She was a courtesan in India at that time. She was supposed to be very, very beautiful, but she was also a very devout disciple of the Buddha. And as she was getting older and her kind of her beauty was fading, she actually entered the monastic order, became a nun, and she is supposed to have become an arahant nun, Ambapali. And one of the very nice things about Ambapali is her verses in the Therigata, the verses on Pali, where she talks about precisely these things, the fading of beauty and how the body kind of gradually declines as you get older. And very kind of powerful verses of Ambapali. But this next part here is about that meeting between the Buddha and Ambapali. So if you are keen on that, please come next time. I don't know when next time is going to be here, but it's hopefully it's going to be before I die. That's kind of the plan anyway. And if not, then we have a problem here. Anyway, yes, Huitong.
Just so that I understand the next episode.
Yeah.
So now the Buddha and his large retinue of monks have arrived at Wajang, right? The Wajang country.
Yeah.
Is that
the they have been in the Wajang country for quite a while now.
Okay. So, but Vaisali is the capital.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. Vaisali is the capital of the Vajrayan Republic. Okay. But the Vajrayan Republic goes all the way down to the Ganges River. So the moment the Buddha crossed the Ganges, he already entered the Vajrayan Republic. Yeah. And Vaisali is the capital. Vaisali was one of the great cities in India at that time. There were six great cities. Vaisali was one of them. So, yes.
Okay, so he's right at the center now.
Right in the center of the Vajrayan Republic, yeah. And this is where the Lichavis were. The Lichavis were the kind of the aristocrats at that time. So these are also part of this thing which comes afterwards. You get the aristocrat Lichavis, then you get Ambapali, and they meet each other, and they have a discussion about who is going to invite the Buddha, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah. And this is exactly the place where Magadha is coveting, right?
Exactly. This is the country that the Magadha, the king Ajatasattu, wants to attack, and he wants to basically win it over. And it is fairly clear that not so long after the Buddha passed away, he did just that, and he conquered that whole area and then kept on expanding across all of north of India.
Which is, of course, because Kosala is already weakened by then, right?
Oh, sure, yeah.
It's kind of, with Buddha, but it's kind of a bit crazy and soon will be wiped out.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah.
Can you actually see where Ambapali's grove used to be?
I'm sure that the Indian Tourist Board has found a place that they claim to be Ambapali's grove, because these are the kind of things that are very useful on the tourist circuit. But whether that actually is the real grove or not is, I think, probably very uncertain. This is one of the things, what is oft claimed sometimes to be a place on the Buddha, and what actually is placed is often not exactly the same. So you have to be a little bit careful with these things. I'm not aware that the real grove has been found. I'm not aware of that. I doubt it, in fact. Okay, anyone else? Yeah? Don't forget to ask questions, yeah? If you don't ask questions, you can risk becoming incredibly dumb in your future life. Chris, you're going to be really smart in the future life, Chris. That's pretty obvious.
Bhante, okay. Yeah. You were saying that nirvana is like you're having little doses of nirvana, these experiences of peace. And you also talked about the idea of nirvana being extinguishment, and one of the images that has been talked about a lot here by the monks, and I assume it's in the suttas, is the going out of the candle flame. Where does the sense of self go when the candle flame goes out? That it doesn't go to the heaven of flames. But my question is nirvana. An experience or an absence of an experience? Now, I do get it. I do absolutely get it, that it is an absence of a sense of self. Got that loud and clear.
Yeah.
But is there experience? Does a person still remain with experience, or are you basically, just evaporating into thin air, psychologically and emotionally speaking?
Yeah. Well, first of all, there's two kinds of nirvana in the suttas. The first one, what the suttas call nirvana is that becoming an arahant. Yeah, that is actually nirvana. So nirvana in the suttas, really what they refer to is the ending of all the defilements of the mind. That is the real nirvana. Everything else is kind of secondary here. Yeah? And I think one reason why the Buddha why he focuses on that particular nirvana is because the nirvana which comes afterwards, first of all, it is just a consequence of the first one. The first one is the goal. That's what we're kind of aiming for. Everything else is kind of secondary here. Yeah. And the second thing is that it is just very hard to understand. Yeah, it's very difficult to actually grasp what nirvana is. And the reason why it is so hard to grasp is because of the sense of self. people, Nibbana can look like something very unattractive, and it can look like something unattractive precisely because of the sense of self. But basically, Nibbana is the way it is defined, you know, the final Nibbana when the Arahant dies, is the ending of the five aggregates, which includes consciousness, yeah? So if consciousness is gone, well, you can decide to yourself what kind of experience you can have at that particular point.
Well, that depends on what you call consciousness.
Yes, it does.
This is yeah? This is where the Mahayanas go deviate from the Theravadas.
Yeah, okay? Sure.
So it really does depend on what you call consciousness about that. But maybe that's a conversation that we can have in the future sometime.
Sure. I think the most important point about Nibbana is that it is ending of suffering. That is what really matters, because that is something we can relate to. But if you go beyond that and you talk about things in a way that is hard for people to relate to, then actually sometimes you just make things more difficult for people. So the Buddha, when you really see how the Buddha talks about Nibbana in the suttas, he doesn't really talk about that. He talks about the goal of becoming an arahant. He doesn't say very much beyond that. What he says is that beyond that, well, the arahant dies, everything becomes cool. Yeah, that's kind of the sort of things that he will say. But he doesn't talk so much about it.
So he's pointing out instructions all the way. He never really says, this is the state.
Yeah, it is the end of suffering, yeah. This is kind of the whole point. The purpose of the Buddhist path is to end suffering. The purpose is not some other kind of purpose. So whatever is end of suffering, that is what we're looking for. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, we're talking.
Just before you go.
Yeah.
So you mentioned earlier that the Buddha obviously had to cross the river, the Ganges River, or one of his major tributaries, right?
Yeah.
He just crossed over.
Yeah.
Is it right, because I missed your last lecture, that the whole retinue of monks and him actually flew over? Should I take that literally?
I can't remember what I said now, 3 or 4 talks ago, what I said about that. So I'm now in danger of contradicting myself. If you can't remember what you said, there's always a massive danger. You'll say the exact opposite the later occasion. I personally wouldn't take it literally. I don't think it is, that's probably not what happened. It occurs there in a verse. I can't even remember now exactly how it occurs. It occurs in a verse, I think. And it has this, for me, it has a kind of feeling of a verse that has been added afterwards by editors or something. The more things tend to be added afterwards, they tend to become more supernatural as they're added, the later they're added to things. For that reason, it's not in the verse, it's actually just part of the narrative, but it is a narrative. Somebody's talking about the Buddha, yeah? It's like a memory of the past, and somebody's trying to remember what happened. I seem to recall that I looked at a couple of different versions of the sutta, and that they are a bit quite different at this particular point. I cannot remember. I think maybe one of the versions actually talks about them crossing over in a more ordinary way, rather than flying over, or the Buddha flew and the monks did not, or something like that. In other words, there was quite a few variations right there in this particular thing. But in general, one of the things that I have found with the suttas, and this has kind of come out of comparative study, comparing the different versions of suttas, is that whenever you have supernormal thing, they tend to vary a lot from one version of the sutta to another one. Generally speaking, the Buddha is not someone who does supernormal feats, generally speaking. When you see them, there's a very good chance that they're not actually real, not actually original, part of the message. Oh, yeah, that is my take on these things. Because the Buddha, the Buddha elsewhere, he says bad things about the supernormal powers. He says that these things are not really. He says that he detests them and abhors them, and these kind of things. And because he says that they don't really work, they're not kind of useful for helping people to understand the Buddha's teachings or becoming Buddhists or anything like that. So they often have a negative effect instead on people in the long run. And that's why he kind of has this negative reaction to this.
I see. So in other words, it's a consistent response that this, the display of public display of ittis is kind of, I mean, quite suspicious.
I would say so. Yeah, I would say it's not something that we is really very useful at all.
I take it that the only exception is with the Venerable Mahamoggallana, that he encourages that, or he allows him,
Even Mahamoggallana, I'm not sure if he displays supernormal powers all that much. He was known to be the one with the most supernormal powers. I'm not sure if he actually displays them many places. Are you?
I think in one major sutta, he used his power to help escalate the construction of the monastery.
Oh, yeah, that one there. Okay, yeah. Yeah, maybe not. I think it's very rare that these things actually form part of the actual conversation, yeah, of the Buddha. Very usually it's part of the narrative, part of the history around it, and that is the more unreliable part of the suttas. The actual word of the Buddha is the most reliable part usually, yeah.
So generally suspicious?
I would say so, generally suspicious, yeah. I'm not saying these things are impossible, I'm just saying that I don't think the monks would have done these things very much, yeah. Lynn, yeah?
Yeah.
Is
non-self synonymous with becoming? Where does non-self fit into that?
Where does non-self fit into the... it fits into really the first one, the very first one, vidya and avidya.
Oh,
yeah, so if you have avidya, you have a sense of self. No, if you have avidya, you have a sense of self. If you have vidya, you don't have any sense of self anymore here. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, let's call it a day. Let's pay respect to Buddha Masanga.